Dean's seminar. It's one of the great pleasures of being Dean that I get to meet our visiting fellows personally. And we had what I at least consider to be a lovely chat a few weeks ago. And it's a pleasure to welcome Professor Penny Lewis, formerly to the School of Advanced Study, and to this Dean's seminar. Penny is Professor of Law at King's College, where she specialises in medical ethics, and in particular the emotive topic of euthanasia. She's also published extensively on child sexual abuse, but she's currently working on a really exciting project that we were discussing concerning the relationship between the criminal law and medical practice. And that is what she's going to talk to us about today.
Thank you very much. I just thought I'd start by getting a sense of the balance between lawyers and non-lawyers, or people who've studied law and people who haven't studied law. I see three people whose background I know, but how many of you are lawyers or have studied law? You have to put your hand up if you've been in my class. Okay, so it's sort of an evenly split. So I'm not going to assume any legal knowledge. Some of you will know some of this, but actually there's hardly any what we would call formal law in this paper. And what there is sort of is at the beginning. So don't worry if you're concerned that your legal expertise doesn't allow you to follow, because pretty soon we'll get on to less formal legal change. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about legally controversial medical procedures, which I've abbreviated as CMPs, or sometimes I call them NCMPs. And the reason, and the N stands for new. The reason why I'm interested in new and controversial medical procedures is because there are some controversial medical procedures, I've put them in gray at the bottom, abortion and euthanasia and assisted suicide, which, although they're controversial, they don't fall into the same category as the ones that I've listed in black. Because they are regulated by specific provisions of the criminal law rather than falling generally within criminal law provisions that aren't designed for them. Although euthanasia in some jurisdictions is regulated by specific provisions, in other jurisdictions it just falls under the general law of murder. So I do have some difficulty distinguishing it, but I have some other ideas on how to distinguish it if anyone wants to pursue that. But mostly I'm talking about new and controversial medical procedures. Now, you'll notice that a lot of these are not new now, but at one point they were new, and their acceptability vis-a-vis the criminal law that was then an issue, and then eventually we get to the point where we no longer think of them as new and controversial, and we're quite clear that they're not criminal offenses. But what I'm interested in is how we get to that point. So the one that's currently in the media, or has been over the last, say, 10 years, is the last black one, which is amputation for bodily integrity identity disorder, sometimes also called body dysmorphic disorder. But all of the ones above that were also legally controversial in the sense of being thought to constitute criminal offenses in their time. And in particular, the one that I've put in bold, although I'm not sure how well that shows up, contraceptive sterilization, is the one I'm using as an example today. So I'm going to look at contraceptive sterilization in depth, but the idea of this project is that eventually I will be looking at all of these procedures across a range of jurisdictions. But I'm sort of doing a little case study on contraceptive sterilization within the UK today. Okay, so how does the criminal law regulate medical practice? Well, at first glance, you might be thinking, what on earth does the criminal law have to do with medical law, medical practice? You might think that generally, while we're aware that a doctor might be sued for What lawyers would call in tort for financial compensation if a medical procedure goes wrong, we're not very aware of doctors being prosecuted for criminal offenses, except perhaps we might be aware that abortion is a criminal offense, although in this country there's a defense to that. And we might be aware, particularly with the state of the media at the moment, that euthanasia can be prosecuted as a murder and that assisted suicide can be prosecuted as the crime of assisted suicide. So if a doctor were involved in one of those, we would think about the criminal law. But we wouldn't generally, if we were thinking about just a regular surgical operation, we wouldn't think about the criminal law. And yet, there's fairly broad consensus across the common law world and pretty much across the civil law world, so for example, continental Europe, that the criminal law does apply to medical procedures. And this is in two ways in the common law world. So the first is the criminal law of offenses against the person, which is a complicated way of saying things like assault and battery and serious assault. So in this country, assault, battery, assault causing actual bodily harm, assault causing grievous bodily harm, and wounding. All of those offenses are in the Offenses Against the Person Act, 1861. Now, you notice that 1861, most of these procedures were not even thought of in 1861. So obviously, they weren't intentionally covered by the drafters of this legislation, and yet they're thought to be covered by this legislation. The other offense or group of offenses that's thought to apply to medical practice is the offense of maim, sometimes also described as mayhem. This is a common law crime in the UK, which means it's not in a statute, but that doesn't mean it's not a crime. Murder is a common law crime in the UK. It's a statutory offense in Canada and most US states. And maim actually comes out of a very long common law tradition of prosecuting, of criminalizing activities which resulted in the king not being able to avail himself of your services as a soldier. So if you shot off your foot or you cut off your trigger finger or blinded yourself or did something or had someone do something to you which resulted in you not being able to serve as a soldier, then you could be prosecuted for maim. But it's not restricted to that, but the kinds of activities which constitute maiming tend to be things that fall into that category. Now, obviously, we know that there's not thousands of doctors being prosecuted every day across the common law and civil law worlds for all the medical procedures they perform. So there must be some sort of defense, right? And in fact, what there is what's usually called the medical exception. And this is a common law exception in most common law jurisdictions, which means that, again, it's not found in a statute. It's described in case law. But it is found in statutes in some common law jurisdictions. So Canada has a statutory medical exception. Its entire criminal code is, it's codified. It's in a code like in the civilian jurisdictions. And New Zealand and two Australian states also have statutory medical exceptions, Queensland and Western Australia. So what I'm really interested in is the contours of medical exception and how these controversial procedures start out being considered to fall outside of the medical exception so that you could be prosecuted for performing them, but eventually are considered to fall within the medical exception. So what is the medical exception? Well, there's two main requirements for the medical exception. The first is consent. So, for example, if I'm having my appendix out because it's ruptured, I'll have to consent to that procedure. Now, you may think, well, what if I'm in no condition to consent? There'll be some proxy for consent. And whatever that proxy is will depend on the jurisdiction. But every jurisdiction has some way of legally dealing with people who can't consent. So when I had my appendix out, I was actually three. And so I couldn't consent because I was too little, but my parents could consent on my behalf in this jurisdiction, because that's how the law deals with incompetent children in this jurisdiction. If, on the other hand, I'd been 23, and let's say I'd been unconscious, then the law would have allowed the doctor to make the decision in my best interest, using either the common law defense of necessity, which was what applied when I was 23, or what is now found in the Mental Capacity Act as statutory defense. So there'll be some proxy. Every jurisdiction has some way of dealing with these cases. And for our purposes, we don't really care about this particular aspect. We're just going to assume that we're talking about a consenting adult. And if you look at back at these procedures, actually, we really are pretty likely to be talking about a consenting adult, because most of these procedures, with the exception of male circumcision, genital mutilation, which is actually in this country a separate statutory criminal offense, and possibly organ donation, are likely to be done on consenting adults. So it's a fairly valid assumption for our purposes. What we're interested, though, is we've got a consenting adult, and we want to know, what more do we need besides a consenting adult in order to make this not a criminal offense? In other words, in order to fall within the medical exception. And everyone is fairly clear that what you need is some kind of public policy justification. People differ on what that actually means, so there's a lack of consensus. And I've tried to look through the ways in which people describe people, courts, judges speaking extrajudicially, academics, etc., describe the public policy justification, and I've, as a result of this, I've divided the public policy justification into three different ways of focusing it, which I think appears in the literature and in the judicial cases. Now, this is a very early example of a description of the medical exception. So this is from a judge speaking extrajudicially in 1925 before the Medico-Legal Society, responding to a paper that had been read by Lord Riddell. And he says, Lord Justice Atkin is talking about the fact that consent isn't enough in order to make an operation legal. There's also got to be, it's also got to be not contrary to public policy. Another way of putting it, there's got to be some form of public policy justification. 1958, Glanville Williams, in a very influential book, again describes the medical exception. Now, he uses language which is very, very common, but it's somewhat misleading. So he's talking about, can the patient validly consent? Well, obviously the patient can consent. Nothing's stopping the patient from consenting. And he's put that word validly in there. And what that really means is the patient's consent enough because there's a public policy justification for this? Or is the patient's consent not sufficient because there isn't? So it's sort of, it's slightly misleading language, but you see it quite a lot, so that's why I've put it in there. So you quite often will see an academic or a judge say, can the patient consent to this kind of procedure? They're not really asking whether or not the patient can consent. They're looking to see whether or not there is some form of public policy justification, as indeed by the time you get to the end of the quote, Glanville Williams admits himself. And these kinds of descriptions of the medical exception continue up until the most recent case in which this was extensively discussed was the House of Lords decision in Brown in the 1990s. So although I've not sort of provided you with quotes all the way through from 1925, 1958, all the way continuing into modern times, rest assured that this is still a valid part of our criminal law. The government's made no attempt to change it, and we still are in this situation where technically every medical procedure constitutes a crime. So I said I divided the public policy justifications into three different focuses. The first is a patient focus. So the operation would be justified, would fall within the medical exception, if it was to the patient's benefit, or what you sometimes see is the use of the word therapeutic. So it was therapeutic, which simply means it benefited the patient. You see this in quite a lot of statutes which are based on Stevens' draft criminal code of 1879, which was intended to be a criminal code for the UK, but it was never taken up in the UK, but it was taken up in a lot of Commonwealth countries. So the New Zealand, Queensland, Western Australia, and Canadian criminal codes are all based on Stevens' draft criminal code. And they all refer to a medical procedure being lawful if it is for the patient's benefit. However, the benefit is not patient-determined. If it was, then consent would be enough, right? Because the patient would be saying, I consent, and thereby am indicating that I consider myself to be benefited by this plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, whatever the procedure was. That's not sufficient. There's some kind of objective scrutiny of what it means to benefit the patient. There's some interesting case law from right across the Commonwealth that a pecuniary benefit, a monetary benefit, is not sufficient. So Wright is a very old English case about one of these MAME offences, a man who had a friend of his cut off his hand, I think, so that he could get some public assistance. That wasn't considered to be a sufficient benefit, and he was found guilty of MAME. There's an American case involving a doctor who anesthetized one of his patient's fingers so that he could then have it cut off by a friend of his in order to claim insurance money, and the doctor was prosecuted for accessory before the fact mayhem. And in the English, the British case of Bland, although none of this maiming takes place, the court does refer to the fact that a monetary benefit's not sufficient. So what we're looking for is some kind of benefit to the patient's life or physical or mental health. And just as a gloss on this, Kennedy and Grubb in their book on medical law have pointed out that what you have to look for is the intent to benefit the patient, because obviously if the operation goes drastically wrong and doesn't in fact benefit the patient, which sometimes happens, particularly with risky procedures, you wouldn't then want the doctors to be prosecuted criminally because simply because their operation wasn't successful. You may wish to sue them in tort, but you may not even have a case in tort because it may be that there was a known risk of the procedure and that procedure eventuated and the patient had indeed been forewarned of that risk and had consented nonetheless. So we're looking for some kind of purpose or intent to benefit the patient's life or physical or mental health. Now, in theory, you could sort of manipulate this category to include pretty much all controversial medical procedures by stretching what benefit means. So you could talk about a kind of psychological benefit. You know, I'll feel better about myself if I have cosmetic surgery. Even more persuasively, perhaps in gender reassignment surgery, you can make an argument that the patient is really suffering in their current gender and would receive a psychological benefit from changing to the gender they believe that they are. Contraceptive sterilization, you can make a case that there's a psychological benefit associated with removing the anxiety about becoming pregnant against one's will. For example, due to a contraceptive failure. More specifically, you can talk about a psychological benefit associated with acting altruistically, for example, in the context of non-therapeutic research and organ donation. Or you could talk about a psychological benefit associated with benefiting someone else who is close to you, which is likely to be the case in live organ donation. So if I donate a kidney to my brother, I receive a psychological benefit from the fact that my brother stays alive rather than dying from kidney failure. Or even I receive a psychological benefit from the fact that he has a better life not on dialysis. That is a benefit to me as well as being a benefit to him. So you can make arguments about the stretching of benefit that would cover almost all these procedures, in which case you may think, well, why bother sort of continuing? The fact is that these sorts of arguments are sometimes made, but very rarely are they sort of accepted. They're sometimes accepted in the context of the lawfulness of procedures involving incompetent adults or incompetent children even, but they haven't really found favor in the context of arguments about cosmetic surgery, gender reassignment, contraceptive sterilization, and other controversial medical procedures. You can also make an argument, and the Nuffield Council has made this argument, that there's an indirect contribution to therapeutic activity, and that should be enough to make it some kind of benefit or patient-focused public policy justification. That only works for organ donation and non-therapeutic research. So it wouldn't really work for gender reassignment surgery. This is a fairly controversial analysis. I mean, some jurisdictions will accept quite a lot of this sort of stretching. Other jurisdictions will not accept any of it. And you see, in relation to one procedure, you see different jurisdictions making really quite contrary arguments. So if you take gender reassignment surgery, I think in this jurisdiction, it's fairly well accepted that there is a psychological benefit to the person who undergoes gender reassignment surgery, and yet there are modern academic writings in Australia and in Ireland suggesting that there is absolutely no possibility of gender reassignment surgery falling under the medical exception. So they certainly wouldn't necessarily accept this kind of analysis. What about the public focus? This is generally broader than the patient focus, so it'll include more procedures. You see different sorts of language. You see just cause or excuse. That's some judicial language from Lord Denning in a case called Bravery, which I'm going to come back to. He's talking about voluntary eugenic sterilization there. The New Zealand Criminal Code uses the phrase lawful purpose. So they would say that any medical procedure which is done with a lawful purpose and consent or some proxy to consent is lawful. Obviously, you then have to decide what counts as a lawful purpose, just like you have to decide what counts as a just cause. Or, alternatively, you could decide what counts as not being injurious to the public interest or being in the public interest. You see that language in the draft criminal code. All of the judges in Bravery, including Lord Denning, use that language. There's a later House of Lords case called Re-F, which uses it. And Peter Skegg, who's a very influential medical lawyer in this area, has picked that up, and he goes on to argue that the procedure has to be in some way socially acceptable. All of these obviously require some kind of further analysis to decide whether a procedure is socially acceptable, is in the public interest, etc. You do also see, though, professionally focused public policy justifications. And when I say professionally focused here, I mean focused on the medical profession. Some of these have some evaluative role for the court. So you see the phrase proper medical treatment in the House of Lords decisions in Bland and Brown. Well, someone has to decide whether it's proper. If all medical treatment were proper, we wouldn't need the adjective. You see reasonable surgical interference. Again, someone has to decide if it's reasonable, because otherwise, if all surgery was included, then we would simply say anything a doctor does is lawful and is not a criminal offense, which is clearly not the legal position. There are, however, another group of these kinds of standards which really do not involve any kind of evaluation by a third party, whether a judge or the legislature, for example, which simply reflect medical practice. So they're simply saying, if it's done by doctors, then it's okay. And you see in Brown, some of the judges talking about good medical practice or practice which is accepted, recognized, or approved by the medical profession. So that doesn't mean that there's no evaluation going on. There may be evaluation going on within the medical profession to decide, for example, whether or not this is good medical practice. But the evaluation is not going on in the sort of layer above that when we were talking about sort of judicial intervention, for example. And this is picked up by an English legal academic called Jonathan Montgomery, a Scottish legal academic called Gordon. The Law Commission of England and Wales uses an approach like this, and a very influential criminal law theorist in Canada. So you do see this sort of analysis across the common law world in both judicial decisions like Brown, in law reform documents, and also used by academics. So one of the things that I'm trying to figure out here is which of these focuses or foci, foci, yeah, focuses, I think, is really the one which actually represents how legal change works. So, in other words, when we look at the procedures which eventually become covered under the medical exception, how is it that are incorporated? Are they incorporated using a professional focus, a public focus, or a patient focus? So legal change on controversial medical procedures. In the UK, we almost never have any kind of formal legal change on controversial medical procedures. There are exceptions. Abortion, a very long-standing exception, which dates from many hundreds of years. We now have statutory regulation of assisted reproduction in the form of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Act, which contains some criminal provisions in it. And female genital mutilation is a modern exception to this, so there is a specific criminal offense for that. What we tend to have more is some legal indications which suggest that this procedure must be lawful because some other things have happened which couldn't have happened if it wasn't lawful. And those other things are state healthcare funding. So we pay for gender reassignment surgery on the NHS. We pay for contraceptive sterilization on the NHS. It must be lawful. And similar arguments are made in the US and Canada, etc. Civil or public law claims for compensation or funding. So there was a case a few years ago about gender reassignment surgery because there was a particular health authority which was never funding gender reassignment surgery. And there was a judicial review of that decision not to fund it. That must presume that gender reassignment surgery is lawful, because otherwise, obviously, they wouldn't have to fund it. Similarly, there's been quite a lot of litigation over failed sterilizations that were contraceptive in nature. So if you can sue your doctor for the fact that your contraceptive sterilization didn't work and you subsequently became pregnant, it must be lawful to perform a contraceptive sterilization, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to pursue that claim. And government regulation. Organ donation must be lawful because there's a whole statute that covers it. But what we do know is none of these kinds of retrospective recognitions of legality are formal recognitions. So we need to, well, at least what I'm interested in doing is looking at how this informal legal change from unlawful to lawful occurs and what we could learn from that. So I want to talk about sterilization because that's the sort of first procedure that I followed through from unlawful to lawful in this project. I'm sure you all probably already know this, but just to sort of make clear my terms, therapeutic sterilization is a sterilization which is done for the medical benefit of the patient, usually in the context of another procedure which is needed. So, for example, someone has uterine cancer, you need to do a hysterectomy to remove the uterus because you're trying to prevent the spread of cancer. A side effect of that is that you are going to end up sterilizing the patient. Eugenic sterilization is done in order to avoid having children who have a particular genetic makeup or may have a congenital disorder. And contraceptive sterilization is done simply in order to prevent the patient from either becoming pregnant or causing his or her partner, no, his partner to become pregnant. Okay, so I'm interested in contraceptive sterilization, but I will talk a little bit about the other kinds of sterilization. But contraceptive sterilization is usually done by one of these means. So either in men, vasectomy, in women, tubal ligation, having your tubes tied, etc., or a hysterectomy where the uterus and sometimes the ovaries are removed. So the historical background to contraceptive sterilization, it was historically generally seen as illegal, and I'm going to look in detail at some of these statements about the unlawfulness of contraceptive sterilization. You see quite general arguments simply saying this is illegal but not really explaining why, but you also see specific arguments saying this is a MAME, or this is an assault, this is an offense under the Offenses Against the Person Act 1861. This is an example of an argument that contraceptive sterilization is a MAME. And this is Lord Riddell in 1925. So he starts off, it may be urged that this is not a MAME as the patient is not weakened as he would be by castration and therefore the operation is legal. Do you remember I said that MAME comes out of this idea that the king needs his fighting soldiers? And so castration is quite clearly a MAME, everyone agrees on that, because castration renders the man less able to fight. Because he's less sort of fired up by fighting spirit. But you can make an argument, and this is what he's referring to here, that sterilization doesn't really do anything to make you less able to fight. Now, Lord Riddell doesn't accept that. He says, this opinion seems wrong. Whatever ethical reasons may be advanced, in law, they amount to illegal maiming. Okay, so he's very clear that this is an illegal maim. Why? Because this is a very serious change, depriving him of his powers of procreation. If this practice became general, the future of the race would be imperiled. Consequently, as the law stands, this is a serious offense against public policy. And this is an argument that is actually picked up in the 1930s by the departmental... The Department of Health had an inquiry on sterilization that was really about whether we should sterilize incompetent people eugenically. But it touched a little bit on contraceptive sterilization. And they very much accepted this argument that that this kind of sterilization would be a MAME on the grounds that you would then not be able to produce more soldiers for the king. So there is quite a clear argument that you can make in relation to the law of MAME here. And this is another quote from the Departmental Committee on Sterilization from the Department of Health. They're not really clear on what it is that's making this illegal, but they're pretty clear that it's very serious, that we need to protect people against their own decisions. They finally talk at the end of this quote about it could be permitted with strong grounds. What that turns out to be is only when it's therapeutic. So in other words, if you've got someone who has a tumor and you need to remove that, or their next pregnancy would be fatal because of high blood pressure or gestational diabetes, something like that. And in 1954, so we're moving on now 20 years, I'm just trying to show you just how clear everybody was that this was illegal. This is Lord Denning, dissenting, but not about, he's dissenting, but the case wasn't actually about this. So all of this little speech that he's making here is actually what lawyers would call obiter, which is sort of extra opinion that the judge gives, which doesn't really... contribute to the holding of the case. And he describes contraceptive sterilization as plainly injurious to the public interest, degrading, injurious to his wife, any woman he may marry, and then he's worried about licentiousness, and it is illegal. He is very clear that it is illegal even though there is consent. Okay, so this is a very clear statement that this procedure does not fall within the medical exception. 1954. 15 years later, by 1968, pretty much everyone who considered this issue was convinced that it was lawful. Now, there had been no court decision since Bravery. There had been no statutory intervention. So without any formal legal change, the law changed, effectively. So what was going on during this time of legal change? I'm sort of starting here kind of in the late 50s, 1960s, and I'm looking through the 60s. Obviously, we know some things happened in the 60s. But in terms of contraceptive sterilization, particularly, when we start at the beginning of this period, there was... a fairly cautious attitude on the part of doctors. The leading textbooks were split on legality. So there were textbooks, medical textbooks, which said to doctors, this is unlawful. But there are other textbooks that weren't so clear or even thought that perhaps there might be some scope for lawful sterilizations. The medical defense societies, now these played an incredibly important role. At this time, before the before the NHS indemnity scheme, every single doctor in the UK would have been a member of one of the medical defence societies, either the Medical Defence Union or the Medical Protection Society or the Scottish equivalents. And they would have been the bodies who would have defended the doctor in court if he or she were sued, which is normally how you would end up in court. You would be sued because the procedure had gone wrong. But also, if you ended up being prosecuted, they would have also defended you, provided it had some relation to your practice. And so if you did something which the defense society had advised you not to do, you would then be in some difficulty in terms of getting your defense, even though you would have obviously paid your fees, but still you had to pay attention to what the defense society said. The British Medical Journal and The Lancet, the two most influential medical journals, were really divided on contraceptive sterilization. So there's some professional caution. There were, however, some challenges to the unlawfulness of contraceptive sterilization. There was a sort of debate that was forcibly brought to doctors' attention by publishing letters and articles in the medical journals and in the lay press. It's really quite impressive when you go through the BMJ and The Lancet for the 1960s, how many articles there were about the legality of contraceptive sterilization. And in particular, I want to talk about the role of something that I had never heard of until I started this project, called the Simon Population Trust, which, I'm not a historian, but they had an enormous influence, it appears, on the legal change on contraceptive sterilization within the UK. And finally, we have public demand. Like I said, this was actually the 60s. There were all sorts of things that you could do that you hadn't been able to do in the past. Contraception was becoming freely available, and women and men were looking for more permanent methods of contraception as well, and one of those was contraceptive sterilization. So let's look at these in more detail. So we start with the Medical Defense Union in 1949, so we can kind of set the stage for how their legal position changed. They took an opinion from counsel, which means they paid some barristers to give them an opinion. And counsel gave an opinion to the effect that sterilization on eugenic grounds is illegal, but it's not if there are valid therapeutic reasons. And then they go on to discuss what might count as a valid therapeutic reason. Well, if it was illegal on eugenic grounds, it was certainly illegal on contraceptive grounds. They didn't even bother to consider that in 1949, although by the time we get to the 60s, they've at least admitted that that's a category. And then in 1960, they again took an opinion from counsel. And you'll notice if you look at the... Well, I'm not sure how well you can read the tiny type, but all of this is being published in the BMJ or the Lancet. So this isn't just some defense union taking an opinion. They then submit articles to the leading medical journals. There were articles by the BMJ or the Lancet's legal correspondent, which would then comment on the opinion given by counsel. So there was very wide publicity for all of these opinions. Now, in 1960, if you read the first sentence, you think, well, okay, we've had the legal change then, we're done. An operation for sterilization is not unlawful whether it is performed on therapeutic or eugenic grounds or for other reasons, i.e. contraceptive reasons. The problem is that that sentence is not then kind of borne out by the rest of the paragraph. Counsel says that, but then they say, well, we're really confident about the first part of the sentence. We're less confident about the rest of the sentence. By the end of the paragraph, counsel are of the opinion that the risk of an adverse finding increases. In other words, the risk that you will actually be found guilty of a criminal offense by a judge, as the reasons for the operation are medically less well-founded. Obviously, the reasons for contraceptive sterilization are not medically well-founded, So they are saying, although at the beginning of this paragraph they seem to be saying it's fine, go right ahead, by the end you're quite worried if you're a doctor that you might be prosecuted. Published in the BMJ, and they also published in the annual report and in the BMJ and in the Lancet this four-point summary of counsel's opinion. So this, I would say, is more representative of counsel's opinion than that first sentence, which was also part of counsel's opinion. Interestingly, many people in favor of contraceptive sterilization being lawful quote this first sentence, but without all the kind of hesitation after it. So this summary, counsel is confident that sterilization on therapeutic grounds would be upheld, well-founded eugenic grounds would be upheld. Now we get to the nub of the problem. Merely on the ground of personal convenience, in other words, contraceptive, might not be upheld. So you might be prosecuted, and you might be convicted and sent to jail. And then, these are the ones that they're really worried about. Where there's a clear element of moral turpitude and damage to the public interest, e.g. sterilization of a prostitute for her convenience. Although some academics at the time pointed out that that might be quite a good reason to sterilize somebody if a prostitute wanted to be sterilized, that actually there would possibly be a public policy justification for that. Recall the language of Lord Denning when he's very condemnatory of the idea of sex without consequences in 1954. You can imagine that if such an operation came before him, he would indeed condemn that operation as damaging to the public interest. So, I mean, the case number four is kind of a scary case that wasn't particularly representative of the reality of gynecologists and obstetricians' practice. But case number three here is the one where you've got a married couple coming into your consulting room saying, you know, we're sick and tired of using contraception. We would really quite like to, you know, we've had four children, we're done. We would like a vasectomy or a tubal ligation. And now you've got the MDU telling you this might not be upheld by a court. So along comes the Simon Population Trust, established in 1957 by somebody called Lord Simon, who had been heavily involved in the eugenics movement. So in the background here we have from the 1920s and 30s a really quite strong eugenics movement in the UK, which then dies after the war when people begin to understand what had happened in Germany during the war. But Lord Simon was still very keen on sterilization, although he did drop his desire to make it to sterilize people without their consent. And he had chaired a population political and economic planning research group on population and was very concerned about world overpopulation. And so he set up this trust with some money of his to promote better understanding of the problems of world population and resources and encourage research, education, and other action, which becomes important, to contribute to the adjustment of population to resources. And the first thing he does is he convinces the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that sterilization is not necessarily unlawful, which was their view. And he also makes strenuous attempts to bring publicity to the Simon Populations Trust legal interpretation, which was sterilization is not unlawful because there's no specific crime of sterilization, despite everything I've said up till now. And he also, the trust also is very keen to keep pointing out how many of these sterilizations are going on. So they want to publicize not only that their view that it's lawful, but also that it's happening. They make repeated interventions in both the lay and the professional press. So in the broadsheet newspapers, in the Lancet, in the BMJ, in the obstetric journals, denying the applicability of the Offenses Against the Person Act and the Law of Maine. And they describe the numerous surgeons regularly performing these operations. There's no good data. There's just anecdotal data. They describe them as many for broadly social reasons. And perhaps most importantly, in 1966, they launched this active vasectomy project, which they advertise in the Lancet and the BMJ. And this is a project whereby if you want a vasectomy, you can contact the trust. They will provide you with information, provide your GP with information, provide your GP with the names of surgeons to whom you can then be referred for the vasectomy, and if you don't have enough money, pay for it. In 5 or 6 months, they had 2,000 vasectomies. I mean, in 1966, they really did make a big impact on the number of sterilizations that were going on, and this continued for the next couple of years. Their legal interpretation, which I said they were wanting to bring publicity to, is that no surgical operation is per se unlawful unless Parliament had so decreed, and the only operation thus designated is abortion. So they basically reject all of the analysis that we've seen so far, which is the law of assault applies, the law of maim applies, and they point out, which many have done, that, you know, what about cosmetic surgery? What about, you know, circumcision? If, you know, why aren't people being prosecuted for these offences? Since they're not, therefore, the Offences Against the Person Act doesn't apply. This was obviously contrary to the opinions obtained from counsel by the Medical Defence Union. So I said they convinced the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And they convinced them not only that the legal position was obscure, but that it was worthy of publicity. So in their report on abortion, which they were preparing because the Parliament was just about to debate the abortion bill, which eventually became the Abortion Act 1967, there's actually a whole section in that report published in the BMJ about sterilization. They talk about potential liability under the OAPA. They refer to the doubts that the MDU Council had expressed, and they talk about the need for clarification being of far greater urgency than the need for a new abortion law. So they really did want this cleared up. Okay, the SPT, after the 2,000 vasectomies, finally manages to convince the MDU that they're being too conservative. They refer to their earlier view. You remember that contraceptive sterilization might not be upheld by a court. The climate of public opinion has been changing. Now, this is the only thing that has changed, right? We haven't had a judicial decision. We have no legislation. The MDU Council feels that a more liberal attitude would now be taken by the courts than might have been the case 5 years ago. Philip Addison, this is a letter to the BMJ. This isn't even an article. Philip Addison was the secretary of the Medical Defense Union. And this is probably the point at which contraceptive sterilization becomes lawful within the UK. A letter to the BMJ. I just want to go back a little bit and talk about the role of the BMJ and the Lancet. In 1960, the BMJ had its doubts about the MDU opinion, at least the sort of first sentence, which was very positive. By the late 60s, they still weren't swayed by the MDU or the SPT, and they refer to the SPT as putting out propaganda, but they accept that the legal position's in doubt. They certainly don't agree with the SPT's interpretation that unless it's a specific criminal offense, it's not a crime. And they cite the risk of imprisonment and prosecution and imprisonment. Now, think about this. You're a doctor. You're trying to decide what to do. And there's an article in the BMJ saying you could go to jail, right? You're not very likely to go ahead and perform these sterilizations if you think that you're going to be risking jail. Particularly if you think about the sort of countervailing pressures. I mean, we know that doctors very occasionally might risk criminal prosecution in terrible circumstances, particularly, let's say, before the development of palliative care, where maybe they might not treat a neonate or they might up the dose of morphine of someone who's suffering terribly. But here we're just talking about someone who doesn't really like using contraception. So the sort of countervailing pressure against the risk of going to jail is perhaps not as great. The BMJ wanted some kind of formal legal change, but interestingly, they seemed to be in favor of sterilization on demand. They just didn't think that it was lawful, and so they wanted something to actually make that clear. The Lancet was more favorable towards the SPT. arguing that the OAPA didn't apply, there was no need for legislation, and agreeing with the SPT and the MDU. However, they thought that a test case could sort of settle it once and for all, but they were worried about male judges deciding on the lawfulness of vasectomy because they thought that male genders were generally squeamish about things like that. It's actually an argument that they picked up from Glanville Williams. I mean, there's no data on which he based his theory, but it's an interesting argument, I think, and may in part explain why there never was a test case. Now, finally, public demand. This is a little graph which is quite nice because you can sort of see the trend. It's actually, we're talking about a very small number of cases here because this is just one hospital, King's College Hospital, the hospital associated with my institution. And the person who wrote this paper was actually the president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, whose name was Peel. And he had followed the number of cases of termination of pregnancy or abortion and sterilization, which are the little squares. Termination alone, which are the little circles, which, as you can see, rockets in 1966. And sterilization alone, which goes up fairly steadily during the 1960s. So public demand's growing. Their willingness to provide it is also growing. Okay, by 1968, the MDU decides to reiterate its position that was stated in that letter in 1966. They repeat the original statement that no sterilization is unlawful, which, you remember, was sort of the beginning of the 1960 statement, but then had all the doubts. And this is an interesting way in which something becomes unlawful. Since the publication of counsel's opinion, no one in authority has expressed a contrary view. So, and no one in authority had threatened prosecution, so they now decided that that there was no risk of prosecution. They decided not to bring a test case because they were worried about what had happened in the abortion context, which was a test case had been brought, and it had been successful, but they thought that the obstetricians and gynecologists were then kind of hamstrung by the wording used by the judge in that case, which was called Born. And they felt that they would have sort of more autonomy if there was actually no judicial scrutiny. And they argued that there was no need for legislation because it was already lawful. So effectively, the SPT has now convinced both the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the MDU to change their views. This is just to recall, you know, just a few years earlier in 1960, what the MDU had said. They were really quite worried, and yet there had been no formal legal changes that had resulted in them changing their opinion. So now legal change is complete, and I'm almost done. By 1969, the debate was pretty much over, and there was almost no debate left. The debate had moved on to whether non-therapeutic, i.e. eugenic and or contraceptive sterilization, should be covered by the NHS. And you see this in other jurisdictions, too, the debate. Once everyone's convinced of lawfulness, then the argument becomes who should pay for it. Eventually, in 1972, there was an amending act which made it clear that such sterilizations would be covered by the NHS. So, how does this work? This is my sort of initial description of this one example of contraceptive sterilization, which I'm hoping to refine as I look at other procedures. I've looked at quite a few jurisdictions, even though I've only talked to you about England and Wales, or the UK more generally. And this does seem to be fairly consistent in jurisdictions where there's been no formal legal intervention. But there's also another kind of problem if you do end up with early formal legal intervention, which I'll come back to. So the yuck reaction, this is a common term in medical ethics, initially, what tends to happen is you get this reaction. Obviously, this is unlawful because it's completely abhorrent in some way. And you get this from judges, you get this from legal commentators, you even get this from doctors who are saying this is morally abhorrent, this shouldn't be done. And you see this about all of these procedures. So you see this about contraceptive sterilization, you see this about cosmetic surgery, you see this about organ donation, even though I think those doubts were very swiftly moved away from gender reassignment surgery, and certainly about amputation for body, for BIID. Then you sort of move into a situation where you have legal doubts and a sort of cautious response from the medical profession. And as that continues, the evidence seems to build, both empirical evidence and also anecdotal evidence, which is published in journals. And what I see in the context of contraceptive sterilization is a sort of rebuttal of the legal doubts in the medical and lay press, which convinces more doctors to act. So the numbers keep, I mean, this isn't really sequential, I've numbered them, but obviously the evidence keeps building. As you convince people that the legal doubts are not worth worrying about, then you get more and more cases. Eventually, the medical insurers and other bodies, like, for instance, the BMA, the British Medical Association, acquiesce, and you end up with a sort of critical mass. You've got hundreds or thousands of these procedures being performed, so how could they be unlawful? And that overwhelms the doubts. So two sort of kind of conclusions here, or sort of notes almost. One is, if we were going to pick a focus for the public policy justification, I suppose the first thing I would say is notice that no one really bothers to explain why it is that this is lawful. They just keep telling you that it is. But it would appear to be that we're talking about a professional focus, because what the SPT tries to do is to convince doctors that this is proper medical treatment, that they can do it, that it is part of a doctor's sort of arsenal of procedures that can be offered to patients. Certainly, the arguments are not being made, you can do this because it's therapeutic. In fact, it's usually distinguished from therapeutic. Therapeutic, yes. Oh, these ones we're worried about because they're not therapeutic. No one's really making much of an argument that publicly the medical exception is sort of being met. Although I suppose what you do see is the MDU does talk about public opinion changing, but that's not really the same as making an argument that the public policy justification is satisfied because this is in the public interest or because there's a just cause or lawful excuse. The other thing to note is this incredible reluctance to seek formal legal intervention. At any time, they could have brought a test case. They certainly could have done a lot more to lobby the government to include sterilization in the abortion bill or to bring forward a statute which would have made it very clear that sterilization is lawful. They did quite a good job of getting it covered on the NHS in a very short amount of time. So had they put even a small amount of that energy into getting the government to just say, yes, it's lawful, then they probably could have had that resolved sometime in the 60s. But they don't, because they're worried about formal legal intervention. So finally, factors in legal change that I'm sort of in the process of identifying and would like to try and refine. One is the importance of a critical mass of procedures that are being undergone or undertaken. And in part, this is a function of time, but it's also a function of the prevalence of the underlying condition. So there's not very many people wanting gender reassignment surgery, so I think that sort of took longer, in a way, for a critical mass to build up. Obviously, there are other factors which also affect, and I'm not arguing that any one of these factors is determinative, but that they all play some role. It's interesting the role of legal arguments within the medical press here. I think that legal arguments actually, there is a big debate in the BMJ and the Lancet about whether the Offences Against the Person Act applies, and most of that debate's going on between doctors. Which I think is interesting. The role of interest groups is really something which surprised me. The SPT had a huge impact. There was a similar organization in the US called the Association for Voluntary Sterilization, AVS, which really did a huge amount to convince people that sterilization was lawful. There was another organization in Canada as well. The role of medical insurers and other bodies, particularly in this country, medical insurers, they played a very significant role, the MDU. Once the MDU changed its advice, that seems to be the critical point. The role of legal medical journals is, I think, interesting. Very little of the academic arguments that appear in academic legal journals ever get picked up or discussed in the medical journals. Perhaps the only one I can think of is that argument that Glanville Williams made about judges being a little bit kind of squeamish about vasectomies, which isn't really an academic legal argument. Finally, the involvement of sexuality. If you think about sterilization and gender reassignment surgery in comparison to organ donation, obviously there are other differences, but the involvement of sexuality seems to be a kind of break on legal change. In other words, it's harder to obtain legal change in circumstances where sexuality is involved. Right, now, plan for further work. Where am I going from here? So what I'm trying to do is identify the process and the factors which affect the process of legal change, looking at each controversial medical procedure and across a variety of jurisdictions, looking both for the kind of informal legal change which I've talked about today, but also looking at formal legal change. So in France, there was a decision about vasectomy in the 1930s, and sterilization wasn't considered to be lawful in France until less than 10 years ago. So the effect of a criminal prosecution in the 1930s, I mean, there are obviously other factors also going on in France as well as that, but that seems to have had a huge effect on when sterilization actually became lawful, much, much later than many other countries which would have had similar sort of population backgrounds, and interestingly, much, much later than when France legalized abortion, which was many years before that. So the impact of judicial decisions, and I also look at the impact of legislative intervention. New Zealand actually has a statute which says contraceptive sterilization is lawful. And so I'll look at that as well. So thank you all very much.
Well, thank you. My initial yuck reaction is increasingly away to squeamishness as you started talking about male sterilization for some reason. But that's not a comment on the excellence of the work that you were presenting. Could I start with a question and then allow others? This is purely as an amateur, but it seems to me in your factors, there's another factor that you could add, or perhaps it's in one of those. And this is a moral factor, because I'm thinking of the Denning remarks in what is it, bravery be brave? Talking about degrading and licentious behaviour. And it's obviously no coincidence that this changes in the mid-60s. And then there was that MDU case, the fourth one about the prostitutes, which uses the words moral turpitude, which is still the main grounds on which a professor can be sacked, of course, gross and repeated moral turpitude. So I just wondered if there's more of a moral sort of issue that comes in here than perhaps in that list.
Yeah, I think you're right. In some ways, I think I would probably incorporate that into involvement of sexuality, but make it more explicit what is going on when we talk about sexuality as a factor in this context. So yeah, I think that's a good point, and I should spell that out. I should spell that out more. At an earlier version of this paper that I gave in Scotland last year, someone brought up sort of trying to think about the sort of history of social change in the 1960s and thinking about sort of Wolfenden and the legal change on homosexuality and various other sorts of legal change related to sexuality. I think one of the difficulties I have with this paper is, in fact with this project, is trying to separate out what's interesting about legal change in relation to these procedures, but without becoming a kind of social historian of the period of time, which I think other people can do better than me. So that's sort of one of the things I try to kind of keep in the back of my mind, that that's not what I'm doing. But on the other hand, you can't talk about, you know, the fact that this legal change happened in the 1960s is not a coincidence.
Yes, yeah.
And yet it's interesting because other jurisdictions also went through the 1960s, and yet they didn't necessarily experience legal change. So one of the things I want to do is look at, sort of compare how legal change happened in some other jurisdictions where, you know, the sort of time period doesn't kind of coincide quite so neatly as it does here.
Okay, there was a request. Thank you.
If I can ask you about the relationship between the state and the profession here, because it seems to me, in part, it reminds me a little bit of the relationship between the state and the church. Till the late 19th century, I'm speaking as a sociologist, yes. The church had absolute control over who married and who didn't. The state had absolutely no role, there was no legal framework.
Mm.
And slowly this was eroded. So that the church had an independence from the state in these matters. Again, as it happens, sexuality, of course, who you could marry, whether you could marry your brother-in-law, sister-in-law, and so on. But in fact, that was much more important than whether you could marry your cousin. So these things were governed by the church. And from a sociological point of view, of course, the medical profession has long had an independence, and the GMC operates independently of the state to a degree. That's a degree of autonomy. So it can register, deregister, it can say whether somebody works or doesn't work, it can admonish, and so on and so forth. So it has that independence from the state, quasi-independence. And so I think it's not surprising that the process you're looking at is cultural and informal, rather than mapping through legal procedures. And the underpinning of that, for just one comment, is of course the question of taboo. I mean, the medical profession has one thing that distinguishes it from all others, and that is it has access to the body. It breaks taboos. And one of the reasons why you might argue for its legitimacy in having this independence is there has to be a fiduciary kind of relationship, a kind of quasi-legal, tacit relationship between the population and the profession, not just the state, to say, well, yes, we allow you not just to do the things you're talking about, even just please take your clothes off, I want to examine you. Where else could you do that in any walk of life? So I think that breaking of taboos is a very strong emotional and social power which the medical profession holds under conditions, certain conditions, which if it breaks, then all hell is let loose, as the Chancellor of the Exchequer might say. So, you know, things are fine while they're going, but if things go wrong. So I think it's not, to my mind, surprising that the process you're looking at is going to be an informal one. Reluctance of the state to get involved, allowing a high degree of autonomy, and then these cultural processes. That would be different in France, because the religious sector, excuse me, that would be the mediating factor. So, although you don't want to be a social historian, it seems to me that's what you're kind of getting into.
Yeah. Absolutely, I think I am getting into it, but I'm, I suppose, sort of trying to look at an area that's not really been focused on from the position of a lawyer, but it's true, you do have to be aware of the context in which you're operating. I mean, I think it's interesting what you say about taboo, because and one of the things I didn't say, but I suppose I was hoping people would sort of pick up by thinking of themselves, is that one way to describe the medical exception would be to also put another criterion in, which would say the touching has to be by a doctor. Because actually, if you've got consent, and you know, if I consent to you taking out my appendix, no matter how wonderfully you do it, it will still be assault causing actual bodily harm. Because the public policy justification actually only applies to doctors. That's why it's called the medical exception. Now, the concern about simply saying anything that doctors do, there's a defense for, there's an exception for, I mean, that would be one way you could go. It isn't sort of how we've gone. Although, you know, maybe we have sort of in all but rhetoric, in the sense that we're constantly saying this is a criminal offence, you can only do it if there's a public policy justification, but nobody ever gets prosecuted. And we sort of leave it to the doctors to sort of decide when it is that a particular procedure is sufficiently accepted by them to fall within the medical exception. But even the people who were doing contraceptive sterilization in Harley Street in the 1920s, because there's quite a lot of ethical, of anecdotal evidence, you see people saying, well, if you're wealthy, you can get one of these, right? Even those people were never prosecuted. Now, partly, and this is how I distinguish euthanasia, partly it's because it's a sort of victimless crime. Nobody complains about it. How is the state supposed to know? Whereas the difference with euthanasia, and to a certain extent abortion, is that at the end of a euthanasia, there's a dead body, and dead bodies have to be reported to the state, and then there's a process of investigation. And so they might discover how it is this person died. And if you look at the abortion prosecutions, John Keown wrote a very good history of this. Actually, the people who got prosecuted usually got prosecuted because the patient died as a result of the abortion. Not always, but most of them. So again, then that has to be reported to the state, and so the wheels are in motion. All of these sterilizations going on in Harley Street never got reported to the state. So,
yeah, close to boundary.
Yeah. But I think that argument about taboo is very interesting. I mean, France, I think, is really quite difficult because... this argument is made about it's a Catholic country and so that explains the difference. But they have a very liberal abortion law, which they've had for an awful long time, and their rate of euthanasia, not sanctioned by the law but nonetheless done, is much, much higher than here and has been for many years. So there's quite a lot of literature suggesting that their medical profession has an even greater status and considers patients to be of an even lesser status than the dynamic that you see within this country.
Very authoritarian.
Yeah. There's a lot of euthanasia, but there's not a whole lot of voluntary euthanasia. it is interesting, but it is difficult to kind of, you know, tease out all of the various factors that are involved.
I'm sure you know it's LGBT History Month, and I can unpack that one if I need to.
I think for the audience that might be nice.
Yes, it's called Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender History Month, which has been going for about 5 years now. And I'm interested in something which has moved the other way, because the evidence is that until the 1960s, people were still being operated on their brains in order to be cured, and they were being offered castration. And the idea of consent was a really strange contract. You know, would you like to go to prison for 20 years, or would you like to have a small part of your brain taken out? Now, I'm not quite sure how much real evidence there is for any of this, and how much of it is urban myths and folk stories. And so there's a sort of historical method problem. But I think it does raise what might be a silence in what you've talked about, which is the role of the police. Because actually it's the police who bring prosecutions in the first instance. And that means that an awful lot of chief constables, an awful lot of county councils, an awful lot, quite a long way down the social process, not just in Harley Street, quite a long way down the social process, nobody was taking any action in comparison with the thousands of police hours that were spent hanging upside down in public toilets waiting to find men doing things, and intervention into people's very private lives with an awful lot of surveillance. And some quite famous cases. So I think in order to explain your one thing, we have to be able to explain at least something else as well. We have to have a comparative approach and a comparative method.
This isn't because of the medical profession. Yeah. Well, reluctance of police to investigate the medical profession.
That's not enough, is it? That's not enough.
In part, there is an issue around thinking about... if we focus on the medical procedures rather than the prosecutions for homosexuality, I think there is a gap you've identified, and it's one that I am planning to fill, which is you not only have... do you have to look at the procedures which become incorporated into the medical exception, but the procedures which fall out of it. And one of the ones which we'd all be familiar with, which it's possible in the next, I don't know, 20, 30 years in some jurisdictions, might fall out of the medical exception, is male circumcision. There's a big movement in Australia to have male circumcision on little children declared unlawful, declared a criminal offence. And there may be other jurisdictions which also move down that road. Now, male circumcision is particularly problematic because it's a very small operation, and so some people have argued that it's not caught by the criminal law in any event. Also, instead of, in contrast to all my other operations, it's usually done on tiny children who are not consenting, or certainly young children. There are other procedures that we might think about that in the past have apparently fallen out of the medical exception. And one is, which I hadn't really thought about, is that surgery to cure homosexuality. Another one is castration, physical castration as opposed to chemical castration, which is still being used. And there is a case on that, on physical castration for a sex offender, in which the court actually refuses to get involved, refuses to say whether or not it would be lawful or unlawful. But it's one of these cases where they promise the prisoner he can get out if he agrees to the... So you as a medical lawyer, you're incredibly worried about the consent, but there's also this issue about the public policy justification. And there were many cases in the U.S. involving those kinds of procedures. But another one that I have looked at a little bit is lobotomy. Because if you read about lobotomy, I mean, when they first start enthusing about it, they think it's like the best, you know, it's like the best of all possible worlds. Look what we can do. We can let all these people out of asylums once we've lobotomized them. And then, and isn't this a wonderful procedure? And they're all convinced it's 100% therapeutic, so there's obviously no dispute that it's in the medical exception. They barely even touch on the question of the medical exception. And then gradually, you know, again, this is the medical profession regulating itself, the doubts emerge, and you know, I think if you lobotomized a patient now, you would be struck off for serious professional misconduct and possibly prosecuted as well. But so there are procedures which are initially accepted or which were accepted for a long time and then fall out, and I do want to look at those. Another one which comes up in this exam, in this context, is when you read about sterilization historically, you learn all sorts of interesting things which I didn't know, at least. They used to sterilize people using radiation, and then eventually they realized it caused cancer. I didn't know that, but if you think about that, if you did that now, I mean, not only would you be sued, but you might well be prosecuted, and you certainly, I think, would be struck off for serious professional misconduct. So certain kinds of procedures or ways of doing certain, or ways of achieving certain outcomes might also fall outside of the medical exception. So yes, at some point during the life of this project, I do want to look at how things fall out as well as how things come in.
Often used to be said, please don't teach young medical students the history of psychiatry. The history of psychiatry, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of psychiatric procedures would have fallen
best
out.
Thing since sliced bread.
sorry. It's rough.
I was wondering whether within the, kind of following on in a similar vein, whether within the history of contraceptive sterilization, we see a kind of a contraflow whereby sterilization for people who are able to request it has kind of, you know, become relatively uncontroversial, has become decontroversialized. And yet we're seeing a kind of increased controversy surrounding, especially in the courts, surrounding the idea that we might sterilize people who have, you know, various kind of mental deficiencies. Mm. And, what the basis for that would be, really, is it the idea that we're kind of interfering with their autonomy, that if they're already incompetent, then...
I mean, really, those cases are an argument about whether in the circumstances the sterilization is therapeutic, which broadly defined, certainly in English law, would be, is this sterilization in this person's best interest? So it's not an argument about contraceptive sterilization or eugenic sterilization, at least not explicitly, but there is a debate about what is really therapeutic for this particular person. And attitudes on that have really changed even in the last 10 years. So that in almost every case involving an incompetent adult which went to court over sterilization, the court agreed that the sterilization was in their best interest, until about 2000, when they started scrutinizing these cases a lot more closely and saying, well, couldn't you just put this person on long-term contraception? Or couldn't, you know, if they're this incompetent, then are they competent to consent to sexual intercourse, and shouldn't you be supervising them a little more closely to make sure that they're not being raped effectively? So there is a sort of change in the way courts view the therapeutic nature of sterilization when the patient is an incompetent adult. But it's within that context. It's not really within this bigger kind of criminal law problem, I suppose. But it certainly is a sort of different view of how one can best take care of those who are unable to take care of themselves, I suppose.
I'm afraid I have to wind this up because I've got to go and share an extremely boring meeting at 2 o'clock, which will be in stark contrast to the excellent hour and a half that we've had on a really interesting topic for just professionals and for lay people like me as well. Thank you so much, and I'm sure everyone will wish to join with me in thanking our speaker once again.
Thank you for coming.